Hello, and welcome to A Door Into the Dark, the English department of TCG's podcast, where we dissect material from the English course, both junior and senior. My name is Sean O'Brien, and I am hosting this week. And with me, I have the very elegant, the very well-spoken Mr. Patrick Murta. Hello, Patrick.
Hello.
So we were deciding this week to take a look at the poet Emily Dickinson, a writer from the 1800s, from New England, Massachusetts, in the northeast of America. She is a poet who is both on the sixth-year course this year, 2023, and also on the fifth years this year. So we said we'd take a look at her and just talk about the sort of features of her writing, why we think she's someone who is worthy of study, and someone to consider writing about, and someone to take some interesting life lessons from as well. I might start by asking you, Patrick, when you begin to teach Emily Dickinson, which is the opening poem? What's the poem you like to kind of kick things off with when you're introducing Dickinson to students?
Definitely Hope is the Thing with Feathers. I think it's, you're often teaching Emily Dickinson, and I do anyway, when she's on the course, start of fifth year, September of fifth year, just to get something concrete to get your teeth into. And I think coming from the junior cycle, where there's so much emphasis on, you know, poetic devices, tone, imagery, that sort of stuff, I think that's a really good poem to get into, and then you can start to look at slightly more sort of advanced aspects of poetry that'd be more sort of relevant to senior cycle. But I think Hope is the Thing with Feathers is just, you've got that nice image, and you can bring in like the idea of the iambic pentameter with the added syllable. And I just think Dickinson is a really good poet to start the senior cycle with, because she's got these very distinct features that set her apart from, or make her unique anyway. Mm. We're always sort of, I think a lot of the poetry questions that come up in the final exams are all about like, what makes this poet unique or different or special or whatever it might be, or what are the themes that they explore in a unique way. And I just feel Dickinson's very, it's quite obvious, and it's
right
there ready, and it's not that difficult to really get into whether you like the poetry or not. It's,
yeah, yeah.
It's just a kind of a useful one to ease into the hot bath of the literature.
She's a gateway poet.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. I always find with that poem, the thing I always ask students, and I'm always intrigued by the response that I get, why is Hope the thing with feathers? I mean, we only really know that the only things that have feathers, generally speaking, that we're aware of are birds and dinosaurs, if you listen to more recent paleontologists. Mm. But why not just call it Hope is a bird, or Hope is like a bird? Why do you think, and I'd be interested in your take on that, why is it that it's Hope is the thing with feathers instead?
I think it engages, everyone has, you know, when you think of a bird, you might think of a pigeon, someone else might think of a peacock.
Right.
And it allows a level of individuality in terms of the interpretation of it.
Mm.
Which is like one of the nice things about poetry, is that we all like interpret it in our own way. We're all reading the same words, but we're all imagining something different, slightly different anyway. But I don't know, it ties in with the whole sort of mysteriousness that surrounds Emily Dickinson as well. She's got like some of the most bizarre yet somehow fitting pieces of imagery in any of the poets that I've studied. So the assumption is that it's a bird.
Pretty safe. Yeah.
But
I like to think of it as like that film Cronenberg's The Fly. Like that it's halfway between the thing it's being compared against and then the thing that is it is itself. So it's on the way to being transformed into the bird, but it's not fully formed. It hasn't found the word to connect to the comparison. So it's like it's almost in the comparison, but then I also imagine it's like a bird, but then it's got like a weird face. That's always the picture I always get when I think of that poem.
I just had a thought: what if it's like quite a luxurious cushion? You know?
Oh yeah,
stuffed with feathers. The word "perched" kind of backs up the idea of a bird, but I mean, it could also be, you know, a nice down duvet cover
absolutely.
Or some kind of comforter.
Yeah.
Which would fit with hope, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah.
It's a bird. a key feature for me in that poem, and I know we'll talk about the common meter and the importance of rhythm in her poetry as well, and it comes up in other poems, but her reaching for the superlative always. So for students, just a reminder, like we have comparison words, you know, you've got like cold, you've got colder, that's your comparative. And then your superlative is the coldest, you know. And Dickinson often just goes like straight to 10, you know, like her volume is turned up all the way, one way or the other, you know. Yeah. And so she engages, she uses like she heard it in the chillest land or on the. What's the landing?
Strangest sea.
On the strangest sea. So it's always that things are like right up to the top, you know, and her emotions in other poems then like follow that track, that they're the absolute to the nth degree. Like things are extremely romantic with a capital or like big dreams or big sweeping statements are her purview. You know, those are the things that she is comfortable with talking about. And it's unsurprising when you find out that she wrote, I think it was like 1,800 poems or something like that in her lifetime. So someone who is that, emotionally kind of charged, it's unsurprising that she's going to want to put pen to paper so often, you know. That's something that kind of struck me. So Hope is the Thing is the one that you would open up with.
Yeah, I think it's the one that I'd start with. Hope's, you know, you're better off starting with that than say like I felt a funeral in my brain.
Well, yeah, let's go. Yeah, let's let's open up that
another,
that one.
Like extreme as well, like a funeral in the brain. Hope. I don't know. Hope's a nice way to start. Fifth year.
Yeah. true. Yeah.
Rather than like the insanity that ensues. But yeah, I felt a funeral in my brain as well. It's got like lots of kind of cool imagery. I love the moment when you get, I always do this, but I always get the entire class to read this out loud. Once you've kind of gone through it and you get this kind of chanting thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it kind of mimics the sort of claustrophobia.
That's really cool.
Of the poem. It sounds like a kind of a tribal chant. You're kind of half expecting someone to like, bring in a lamb on a rope to slaughter or something. There's this kind of mad atmosphere that arises from it.
Yeah.
And especially when you get to like the second stanza, the drum beating.
Yeah, yeah.
That's always kind of fun. But yeah, I think I felt a feeling in my brain's another example of her having kind of attaching seemingly, you know, unconnected images and feelings together, particularly that last stanza, like the plank in reason and this idea of being reduced to only an ear and only experiencing the world in a kind of auditory way. It's just a very interesting exploration of like a deteriorating mindset.
Yeah. I love the poem. There's loads of little bits in it. One thing I kind of noticed with a lot of her poems, and this is a good example of it, is where they're not necessarily paradoxes, although some of them are, but the opening state, so for all of Dickinson's poems, the opening line is the title of the poem, but I felt a funeral in my brain immediately engages the reader as to what is she talking about? You know, like, how do you feel a funeral, firstly? Like, you attend a funeral, or, you know, you cater a funeral or something like that. But firstly, it's the felt immediately, like your sensations or your senses are being like discombobulated straight away. Yeah. And then the position of it, that it happened in my brain as well. So you're getting like, you're just becoming disorientated right, like, from the off, you know, that your title automatically is bringing you into uncharted territory, which is exactly the plan there, is to make you feel that total lack of security and like stability. Another line, or another aspect of the poem I really liked, was that the amount of lines that begin with the word "and," that you're sort of and then this happened, and then this happened, and then drop it down and down, and then, but there's a name on that. I think it's like polysyndeton or something like that. There's it's a poetic technique where you keep, rather than you keep thinking you're going to come to the end of the sentence and then another clause comes in and then another one comes in, but it's done for dramatic effect, to make you feel like, oh God, and now we've fallen lower and we've gone lower and lower and lower.
It brings a kind of breathless feeling to it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of adds to the anxiousness of it all. There's no pause for break or reflection, as you said. It's just kind of like tumbling down and down and down. It kind of reads like those early diary entries that you do in first
Yeah, we cut the grass and then we played football and then we had cake.
By the end of it, we were just breathless.
Yeah, no, it's like there are a number of I get into sort of a I don't know if a row is the right word, but I get into debate with my students on one of the other poem that's often tied in with "I Felt a Funeral," which was I heard a fly buzz when I died. I'm sometimes drawn to I'm really intrigued by the context within which Dickinson wrote. So Dickinson was raised in like this Puritan background. You know, it's a well-educated sort of middle-class family who, you know, prized the intellect and prized reading and prized, you know, religious worship and discipline in their lives and everything like that. And so they were brought up in quite an idealistic space, and there was a very clear ordained order, you know, God created heaven and earth, and that, you know, and everything kind of comes down from there. And when Dickinson is like a curious older teenager, young 20s woman, she reads Darwin's The Origin of the Species, and like it's hard for us to now imagine what it must have felt like when The Origin of the Species like arrived into people's minds.
I'd say it was similar feeling to when we were doing Bishop. The waiting room. It's a similar kind of like, your head just explodes.
Yeah.
Kind of feeling.
Like the whole order of what we thought worked. Yeah. Actually, no, we're not descended from on high. We ascended from
the sea.
Yeah. We were fish before, you know?
Yeah.
And so like, I think that from my reading of Dickinson, I see a couple of her poems where she's sort of grappling with the idea of like, she clearly has religious like belief and faith but is questioning it actively. And when she hears the fly buzz when I died, I think it's sort of her in a sort of darkly comic tone mocking the idea that the fly is going to, you know, eat her when she decomposes and everything.
For sure, yeah.
And go on, yeah.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I feel like fly buzz is more, there's a comfort with this realization.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, some of her more like depressing stuff is like coming to terms with everything I believed is not what I believe now.
Right.
And the identity crisis that occurs with that. And then there's definitely like, there's a lot of dark humor.
Yeah.
Evident in I Heard a Fly Buzz, like the idea of the fly and the kind of, what's the word? Signing away the will. There's just something like, I don't know, there's a dark humor to the way, definitely. The way that she...
When she signs away her keepsakes, yeah, and it's like, you know, for most people, the concern is, yeah, that you're going to sign away, like, oh, and Jim gets the fancy armchair and, you know, someone else gets the trumpet. But, like, her keepsakes are, like, her physical body, and the fly has come to claim his part of the will now, you know, that he's going to, he's going to take over that aspect of her after she dies.
I love the idea that, as well, we have... we have these moments where we kind of think about what our deaths will be like, and it'll be this kind of big moment where, like, the room lights up and it's very dramatic. And I just have this image of, like, you know, a solicitor in, like, a suit just, like, popping in. Like, well, would you mind just, like, this, like, limp hand just, like, signing off on those last little few trinkets?
Yeah. Yeah, he needs the commission for it as well. Like, exactly. It's a battered old suitcase, and he's like Lionel Hutz from The Simpsons kind of coming in. Yeah, I know. And even like she really ramps up that idea of how serious it is, and like in the opening stanzas, like how she's kind of like popping the balloon of like seriousness or pomposity around. Like, because of course we take our mortality very seriously, but. Yeah, she's kind of going, yeah, but also we're fly food as well.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, doesn't suit our kind of protagonist outlook.
Yeah, exactly. And and like even she even really sets it up well by talking about the king about to enter into the room, which, like, I always think of Elvis when I read this poem. I was imagining, like, Dickinson is there in her, you know, on her deathbed, and like Elvis kind of shuffles
the
into
white
this. But yeah, so like obviously that's not what she intended, because Alice wasn't around, although I wish it was, unfortunately. But like, so instead of it being, you know, God coming in to take her away, she just hears this like annoying blue, uncertain stumbling buzz.
Yeah.
It almost sounds like the fly is drunk, like walking in, you know, like totally disrespecting in every single way.
Yeah.
He just kind of rolls in, like, oh, that's mine.
Yeah. Ooh, yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think it's brighter than maybe she gets credit for, because a lot, like,
there's some really beautiful stuff in there as well, like the stillness in the air between the heaves of the storm. Like, I think that's a really kind of quite beautiful. I mean, it's also kind of disturbing. I always think of that as like the chest.
It's the struggling. Last few breaths.
But it's kind of a beautiful way of putting it as well. In a very morbid way. So there is, like, undeniable beauty within that poem amongst the kind of, dark humor. It's a weird one.
I feel like we're going to say that about most of our poems. It's a weird one, But for me, the poem that's, like, I don't know, bleakest, or, like, one that saps the energy out of the room is There's a Certain Slant of Light. Like, that for me, that's, I think it's an incredible poem. It's kind of like, I don't know if people know of the seasonal adjustment disorder, you know, where you, like,
big time.
Where for anyone who isn't aware of it, basically it's where you, like your energy and your mood and stuff is tied to the weather outside. So, or the climate, basically. So it's the amount of daylight you get in the day. You know, a common, like, phrase that used to be said was that, you know, like in Finland, depression was more common than the common cold, because, like, you know, there are long periods where it's extended periods of darkness, you know, in the far north. And, you know, this poem really strikes me as someone who, before something like that was diagnosed, like 100 years before it was diagnosed, this is someone who was experiencing that exact mood and puts pen to paper in a beautiful way to describe it, you know. Would you normally teach this poem when you're
definitely I'd usually go to this, like, quite early on as well. I love I often think of that certain slant of light because of the, like, the religious imagery involved in it. I don't know if this is like a childhood memory that I have deep in my subconscious or something, but I always pictured, like, a beam of light coming in through, like, the stained glass in it's actually like the church up in Delgany that I had to go to a few times as a kid.
Mm.
But I always consider, I always think of that, but also that there is that very distinct morning light.
Yeah.
That comes that, you know, the depths of winter, but those those crisp days where, you know, it's like, it looks cold.
Yeah.
It's bright and it's, it's like clear, but it is, there's a coldness to it.
Yeah. You look at it and you're like putting your coat on. You're like, oh, Sheenie Mac, it's going to be like crisp and cold. Yeah. And
it'll take a few minutes for the car to heat up.
Yeah.
For the windshield to clear out.
I do wonder because, like you say, when you say that there's a certain slant of light, immediately everyone's drawn to a different picture of what that light is. Like, I'm very lucky in that where I'm from in the countryside, like there's a couple of quite nice panoramic views. And like you get this big, just over the sea and over fields and stuff like that. And you can see like you can actually see like slants of light actually hitting different fields and not others and stuff. And in the like depths of winter, the sun is lower and it's like, it's just really dramatic and powerful. And it, it's kind of awesome in the originally intended definition of the word.
It feels like, In this poem and those particular sort of beams of light, it kind of reminds me of some sort of I don't know, laser that would exist in like a surgical department or something, just to kind of penetrate and examine the core of something. And this is a poem about something that's like internally felt.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, it's a very striking image.
My favorite part of this poem is how it relates to all of her other poems. So for those who maybe are just about to read Dickinson, Dickinson's style was incredibly traditional. So like a lot of your Leaving Cert poets are going to be from the 20th century. And so poetic style was being experimented with quite a bit. So you don't have your traditional rhyming schemes often, but Dickinson, absolutely traditional rhyming schemes, alternating rhyming couplets almost every single time. And she wrote in what's known as the common meter, which is like an 8-beat and then 6-beat and then 8-beat and then 6-beat in her 4-line stanzas. So you can sing almost every one of her poems to the rhythm of I'd Like to Buy the World a Coke. It's like this, the same rhythm to it. So like... what's the one? I taste a liquor never brewed from tankard scooped in pearl. But like almost all of them have the 8, then 6, then 8, then 6, except for There's a Certain Slant of Light. And it's the only one where every single time it cuts one beat short. So it's like 7 and then 5 and then 7 and 5. There's a certain slant of light, like pause, winter afternoons, pause, that oppresses like the heft pause of cathedral tunes. So it is literally like, it's literally like she can't quite get the energy out to finish the rhythm or finish the usual experience that she's having. Like she literally is cut short in the sound of the delivery of the poem. Aside from like the incredible imagery that she's got, it's just that sense of that she doesn't quite have the, because of that certain slant of light, she doesn't have the energy to kind of reach to the end, you know.
And the word, I like that the what's off about the beat is the word light.
Yeah.
And therefore that word is highlighted.
Yeah.
Isolated.
Yeah.
One feels isolated when feeling these feelings. And yeah, it's lowercase as well, which kind of
which is odd for her. Like
exactly. So the central idea, the central image is written in lowercase, isolated from the rest of what would be a traditional flow to the poem, but also mimicking the isolation that she's kind of experiencing.
Yeah.
When writing this, I love the end of this poem. It's like the idea of when you feel crap or grief, there's this idea that like it will one day end and I will be fine and like life will be great.
Right.
Because this is so bad.
Yeah.
But it, the reality is that life doesn't work that way, and grief doesn't just end, or depression doesn't just end. There's not a day you wake up and like, I'm free. It's not like a cold or something like that. It's a slow, almost imperceptible period of time. And it's not like there's this like dramatic moment. So she's the lines like, when it comes, the landscape listens, shadows hold their breath. When it goes, it's like the distance on the look of death. So it's this kind of slow, distant idea of grief ending. I don't know. It's just, it's an interesting kind of take on.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's when you're in that moment, it's impossible to feel like there's a
anything
afterwards. Yeah. It's, the poem again, like it's, there's two things I'd sort of encourage for the students to take from this is that number one, that it's really helpful to look at a poet's like individual poems, not in isolation, but through the context of looking at all of them together. And that's really when you're studying a poet's work, like you're never, you're always asked about the poet's work as a, as an entirety. So it's good to look for links within them. And the other thing to kind of point out, or I think is an important thing to point out, or that I would always do with my classes, is that the style and the content, like what the poet is writing about and how they're writing about them, about those ideas, are in the best poetry, they are inextricably linked. Like they tie one another in. So because it just, as Patrick, you were saying there, that using that dropped beat to discuss light allows for more emphasis to be placed on it. So it's well considered from both sides. Another poem that for me, like the exact opposite to that poem, is I Taste a Liquor Never Brewed. Like it's exactly the opposing point. Like it's the other side of the year. It's in the middle of summer. Dickinson, she has this beautiful garden outside of her home, outside of their family home. She used to keep like a herbarium, a book of pressed flowers that she was so, she was like a keen amateur scientist looking at all of the different plants and stuff like that. And this poem, she just discusses the sheer ecstasy of being out in her garden in summer. Oh crap, the bell just went.
Was that for break or to signal the end of break?
I don't know. My goodness.
It's 11.
It's 11.
It's 11.
So we have 20 minutes.
So we have 20 minutes.
20 minutes.
Strap yourselves in, folks. It's 20 minutes of I Taste a Liquor.
Yeah, it's like her poetry. We were talking about the sort of binary nature of her poetry and going from like the lowest to the highest. Like, I think comparing these two poems works very well in that. It's alarming.
It comes with a health warning.
Calling the guards if she saw such a sight. She's high on life. Is what I always tell the class.
Yeah,
But it's such a, you could see this poem as like a cartoon that we would have watched as kids.
Yeah.
There's a kind of a cartoon that like these kind of bumblebees with tankards.
Yeah,
like, kind of. Falling out the fox gloves and stuff.
Yeah.
It's very kind of, there's a kind of a childishness to it.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, it's quite nice, but obviously in the context of things, it's probably more sad than it is nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I always feel after reading it that I'm kind of worried about her, you know, like she moves from smelling a few flowers in her garden and going, oh, isn't this lovely? That till she takes this sort of metaphysical journey up into the clouds, and the only thing that can kind of chill her out a bit is that the saints and the angels start like, you know, showering snow onto her basically or something.
So
it's not made quite clear, but she just takes this spiraling like, it's kind of cartoonish is a good way to describe it. Yeah, it's like,
this is literally the best thing ever.
That's ever happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. There is no high that can be created. Like, I taste a liquor that was never brewed. Like, you know, it's not possible to feel the elation I'm feeling here, you know?
I love the image of the little tippler leaning against the side.
I've had too much to drink. I need to be placed. Please phone my wife. Yeah. It's so intense. And the inebriate of air am I, and debauchee of Jew. Already at that point, you know, she speaks, she writes in fairly accessible, common English for most of the time when she's writing.
Yeah.
So even for her to elect to use words like inebriate or debauchee, even that means we're already taking a bit of a departure. I feel anyway that she's trying to, describe the level that she's experiencing is just on another plane to what's normally the case. I suppose that's, in summary, I guess, to talk about Dickinson is to talk about the extreme highs and lows of life, in a very, I think, accessible and traditional format, but with very peculiar and unique imagery to discuss those things. She's an excellent poet to begin your discussions with, or to begin your study of Leaving Cert poetry. And I think you mentioned, Patrick, that she's definitely someone to well prep for an essay, because it's usually a nice one to write about.
Yeah, I'd say she's one of the easier ones to write about, because her poems are they're so separate from each other.
Yeah.
Yet all interconnected, but they're very, very distinct. They've all got this central striking image that the poem is kind of crafted around. They're rich in imagery. There's just so much to say about them. And if you consider approaching any poetry essay, you need to focus on, like you were saying, style and substance, language and themes. There's just so much there that even if you felt totally unprepared, I think you'd be able to write a half decent essay on Dickinson.
Yeah, great. Cheers.
Thank you.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love, grow apple trees and